Welcome, everyone. It's 2 o'clock. This is a 90-minute session. We're gathered together under the title, The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, One Year Later, A Report. I'm guessing that many of you are here as having read the book or are interested in the book, or you love Carolyn Pearson and you can't miss a chance when she's going to speak to us and things like that. So we're grateful that you're all here, and I imagine many more will be coming back as their lunches end. We are thrilled to be in this gathering to talk about a book that Carolyn talks about as perhaps her most important book. A year ago, the book Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, Haunting the Hearts and Heavens of Mormon Women and Men came out, and I know it connected with lots of people. We're hoping that you are among those people that connected with either your stories, your own, you know, family things or something. And if more than anything else, we're considering this a storytelling session. Carolyn is not going to really speak for all that long. None of our three panelists are here to speak for a long, long time or to do any kind of treatise. But everyone here is just to share stories of the impact of that book or the impact of having their situation described to be validated and things like that. However the book affected you, we absolutely want to spend 45 minutes to an hour of you really interacting. You can ask questions of Carolyn, share your own reactions, your own hopefully gratitude, but even if it was a challenge to you, we want to hear that as well. So I'm grateful to introduce this group panel. Let's just quickly go over the quick sunstone reminders here for all chairs. Cell phones, etc., right? Silenced or whatever. You don't want to be embarrassed by those ringing. Sunstone is a nonprofit organization. Who caught the three degrees of sunstone glory sign? Right? What are they? What are the 3 degrees to be a truly celestial sunstoner? Okay, yeah. Well, you're already doing one. You're attending the symposium. Number two, you're subscribing to the magazine. It would be wonderful. And number three, you're a donor. So if you want to go to the Celestial Kingdom, it's a little easier here at Sunstone than some. No, just mess with you. But just a reminder. Another thing to remind of, it's been neat the last couple of years that these sessions are basically ready almost by the time you get downstairs. So right there in this corner, right below this part of the student union there, you can get these audio recordings on a flash drive. I think you can bring your own flash drive and they'll download it to that too, or you can buy a Sunstone flash drive and do it. But they're way less expensive than they used to be, and so if you've missed something that you're like, oh, I was torn between two things, go get them that way. But also, if this is an important session to you, we hope you'll relive it or share it with other people. So of course, our group up here, Carolyn Pearson is, you know, the author of this wonderful book. It was a big privilege of my life to work with her in some of the fine-tuning editing processes and things like that. She's, of course, written No More Goodbyes. She's a poet. She's been an important voice and a wonderful model, I think, for activism within Mormonism while being beloved, while you know, working with leaders and loving as well as critiquing and all those at the same thing. She's just such an important model for us and all that. And this book brought all of her skills together to talk about why she loves Joseph and why she hates Joseph at times, or why she loves this community and has faith in this community even when it makes bad decisions or it is so slow in things. And so we're so grateful to have her. As I mentioned, this is a storytelling session. Our other three panelists are here just to really briefly share the impact of this book or this subject upon their life. Once it came out, how did it affect them? So we'll have Geralee Henderson Renshaw. It's like I never think of her middle name except when you're on Facebook and places like this where you see, you know, the full-on name. But Geralee Renshaw is from Alpine. And she and I became friends 7 or 8 years ago. And more than anybody else, there's this wonderful sacred space on the internet and Facebook called the A Thoughtful Faith Facebook group, which is about 2,500 to 3,000 people now. It's probably one of the most heavily moderated groups, and Geralee is our main moderator there. So it's not a Facebook group where you can just say, hey, here's what I had for dinner. or here's my latest blog post, or, you know, this or something like that. It's like, if you have something to share within Mormonism and you're trying to stay engaged, you're trying to have a constructive take, you could still share, you can still be upset, you can still say, this is really bugging me right now, but to try to do it without globalizing, therefore the church is evil and everybody should leave with me, in that kind of space. But Gerald Lee is our hardest working moderator. I'm on the moderator team, so I see she's just amazing. Jane and Jay Griffith are good friends. They host, well, they're among the organizers for a group that's in Salt Lake monthly called Faith Again, along with Mark and Elizabeth England. It brings in a speaker every month. We had Adam Miller just a couple of weeks ago. We had Richard Bushman. We have the Givenses when they come. I've spoken there. lots of wonderful things. So they're just very active in getting good discussion going within Mormonism. But they're in the book. So you know how Carolyn has a chapter or two, and then she'll have voices? Jay gave word to a story of him and Jane, and they're among the anonymous people there, and they're going to fill you in on that. So after just this, they're priming the pump. There's a microphone right up here on this first chair, and we just hope after this, the rest of you will come up and share something close to your heart about this book and this topic. So thank you. Carolyn.
Dan, thank you for this. Thank you for so many things. Thank you for your enthusiasm about the ghost of eternal polygamy when I first sent you the manuscript and asked if you'd like to help edit it. Your enthusiasm meant a lot to me. And thank you all for being here. Boy, doesn't a year go fast? I can't believe it's been a year since I launched this book here. And a year ago, I was a big hit at Sunstone because of The Ghost of Polygamy. You know why I'm a big hit at Sunstone so far this year? My boots. And why I'm a big deal at Sunstone this year, it's all due to my boots. But if I had to choose between the boots and the book, I would choose the book. So what has happened in the year since this book came out? It's been a good year. It's been a very good year for me and for the book. But I didn't know what to anticipate last year when this whole thing exploded out into the year that we have just seen. I was really anticipating that I was going to be the center of a big firestorm, that there was going to be a lot of controversy, and that I was going to get quite a lot of difficult, threatening kinds of things. That has not happened. Not at all. For me personally, at least 95% of the response that I have received in person, in email, on Facebook, has been very positive. And the minimal amount of maybe 5% of negative response does not even... Oh, I would take so much more than that in order to have been able to give to the people who needed what I have to give. So, you know, being loved last year at Sunstone is one thing, because here everybody is, you know, sort of on the same weird wavelength that would produce something like The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy. But I knew that, you know, going back into my ward would prove a lot of things. So I'll tell you what my immediate response was going back into my ward. So on the first Sunday that I was there, and I didn't tell anybody about, well, no, I told a couple of people about the book, but nobody in general knew. Well, my bishop did, and I might tell that story in just a little bit. But so I walk into Relief Society, and the woman who's about to give the lesson comes over, and she grabs me by the shoulders, and she says, "You woman, you. You woman, I finished your book, and it has taken this huge load off my shoulders that has been on there forever. So thank you for that." And then in the hall, one of the men that I don't even know sidles up to me and says, "My mother said to tell you that she loves your book." So I gave him a hug and said, "Give that to your mother." And let's see, a woman in my ward who just had her 90th birthday called me months into the existence of this book, and she said, "Carolyn, I am calling to tell you that I almost called you at 1:30 this morning. I was finishing your book from 11:30 to 1:30, and it is fantastic." So, and here's what I got from a woman that I visit teach in my ward. An email. "I'm an instantly happier Mormon knowing I don't have to believe in polygamy. I didn't before the book, but I just feel happier now that I believe there is hope. It really addressed all of my issues about a male-centered religion. Thank you and bless you for putting your neck on the line. I stand with you." So that is what I received and what I continue to receive in my ward. And I would just wish that everybody here who has some unusual, challenging thing to bring to the church could have the ward and the stake that I do, for which I am very grateful. Well, let me just share with you just a very few of the negative responses that I received, because really that is such the small part of what I received. Well, a number like, "The vast majority of living LDS who have polygamous ancestors can tell you about the blessings. Get with the program." Here's one that's just a couple of weeks ago. It's fairly long. I'll just take a little piece from this. "Why did you not sign?" I tell the story in the book. Those of you who have read it know the story of my great-grandmother and grandfather. She left him the day he brought home a second wife. And I discovered during the process of writing the book that Brigham Young had gone up there and given a sermon that anybody who refuses to take a second wife will lose the one wife he has in the celestial kingdom. So I do tell that story. And this woman says, "Why did you not side with your great-grandpa who was following the prophetic counsel? He did not betray her. She betrayed him. She left him. She heard the prophet too and should have understood her husband's action was one of obedience. What makes you different from the apostates of the early church who were privileged to have a voice and then when they became disenchanted with their sufferings and mortality, decided to turn in opposition and take advantage of the church's former gratitude and resultant leniency to lead others astray and destroy their confidence in the church, in the Lord's chosen prophets? I can see how you have fallen since your early days, and I mourn for you." And of course, that's an appropriate response from someone who truly, truly feels that the most important thing in the world to do is to follow whatever prophetic counsel is given to us at any given time. The very excellent scholar Brian Hales, I sent him an email asking if he had the book and I'd like to send him a signed copy. He said he already had one and had actually written a review, And he said in the email, "You may be surprised to learn that I was more concerned about your positioning Joseph as just another visionary and placing the church as being as useful as other religious traditions." So those are a few of the 5% really, honestly, of comments that have come to me personally that were not appreciative of what I had done. But for the others, I was just personally so thrilled to get tangible evidence that what I'd hoped for and what I had done all this work for was actually blessing relationships, actually opening doors of communication between husbands and wives. So let me just share with you a few of those emails. And I'm reluctant to do this really because these all sound so self-serving. But there's no way for me to read some of these to you except that they have to sound self-serving. And that's kind of why we're here in the first place, to see what has been experienced by me and by others in this year. And these are just anonymous from various places. "I ordered a book for me, my bishop, and the area 70 in my ward. Faithful CLP may be the only one who can help us banish and finally repudiate this haunting error. Maybe we could all flood our wards with copies. It's hard to find an accurate and powerful enough adjective, profoundly moved by your Ghost of Polygamy book. As a man, and even while serving as a bishop, I never came close to thinking about what the idea of polygamy says to and about women. Thank you." This is kind of funny. I have a dear local friend who has a Utah friend that they communicated about this book, and the Utah friend says, your friend Caroline's book is being read by all the women around here, and these are faithful Orthodox women, and they seem to love it." And then the Utah woman asked my friend, "If I read the book, will it make me want to go back to church? Because I don't want to go back to church." "I devoured the book in 2 days and have never, ever felt so empowered in my life. Carolyn, I'm so grateful you've had the guts to write and publish this book. I believe it will help my husband and me heal from some very old, deep-seated wounds and give me language to use when speaking up about it in the future." Healing is the best word I ever want to hear from anybody about my work in any way at all. Healing is what we're here for. Oh, here's a line from our friend Bob Reese. "Reading your excellent book, I thought of Melville's letter to Hawthorne right after he finished Moby Dick. I have written a wicked book, and I feel spotless as the lamb." "My husband is now reading it, and he is so much more understanding than he was before, and we're having some very deep talks, which we could not have had before." Deep talks. How we do need deep talks. "As an active LDS woman, I long for voices that express the need for equality, but also honor the faith I deeply cherish and do not want to abandon. Your book most eloquently did both. Thank you." And from my new friend, Kristen Decker, I think she happens to be in the hall. But I'll read you a couple of, right over there. Am I right? Is this Kristen? Yes, that's it. And I hope you'll hear from her, maybe, but because I have them, I'm going to read what you wrote to me, just a couple of the lines. And Kristen was from seven generations of polygamists, and was married into polygamy with all of the heartaches that entailed. She now is one of the heads of the organization Sound Choices Coalition, which, if any of you want to find a good organization to support, that is working to help women who come out of fundamentalist polygamy to become educated, to find ways to support themselves and get back into ordinary society. See Christian and devote yourself in some way with your home or some financial help to her Sound Choices Coalition. And to me, she wrote, those of us on the Sound Choices Coalition have felt like we've been all alone in addressing these issues. Speaking of the harms, the ghosts of polygamy, because you are an honored and revered woman, you have added more competence and influence to this cause than you can even imagine. Women's, children's, and men's lives have been and will be changed because you dared stand up for them for truth and righteousness. My days are full of gratitude to you, Carolyn. Oh, how happy that made me, Kristen. I wish there were words enough to express the extreme appreciation we feel for you for writing this book. You've changed the world in millions of ways in the past and now even more. So, Kristen, thank you for that. The book sat in my Amazon cart for 3 months before I had the guts to bring it home and read it. I somehow knew it would change me. I love that you made it possible to believe in our restoration prophet and at the same time acknowledge that he could error in a great big way. I haven't felt a way to reconcile that before I read your words. Here's my man. I'm a true believer, lifelong member, just finished reading the book and want to express your gratitude. The book, this is the book that most needed to be written. And another one from a man. I found your new book spellbinding, exhilarating, and tragic in content, and gratefully uplifting in spirit. The book is a classic, a milestone along the way to the Zion society we yearn for. And I received a very long email from a very, very prominent man whose family name all of you would know. He happens to be a bishop. And at the end of his very long, enthusiastic email, he said, my wife asked me more than once if I would marry eternally should she die first, or if I would marry eternally to others if I died first. I used to tell her if she had all the truth, she would be more accepting of it, and that I would never go against the plan of salvation. Now, 30-some-odd years later, I simply hang my head in shame. My sweet, lovely, angelic, saintly wife, my best friend, how could I have put her through such pain? I took my best friend into our room, closed the door when we were alone a few years back, held her hand and tearfully apologized for ever having made her feel that I would share with anyone else what she and I have. I asked for her forgiveness for my thoughtlessness and callousness. Thank you for your book and openness. It has been far too long since I literally became tearful reading a book. Thank you 1,000 times over. I owe you a debt of gratitude. This one just came in recently. I love this one. I'm reading your latest book, and it's a wonderful, beautiful experience. It's opening doors of understanding and communication between me and my wife. We discussed it at family home evening with my 12-year-old son and my 14-year-old daughter. I never would otherwise have guessed, but my daughter was already feeling the angst of this issue. Her close friend's parents were just divorced and are remarrying, leaving this 14-year-old girl overwhelmed with the logistics of whom she is sealed to. Thanks so much for your work. I am grateful. I need to thank you for writing your book on polygamy. Hallelujah. I feel like the ground has shifted below my feet. I am angry, relieved, free, comforted, and on my way to being whole. I will build new footings now, and my daughters will not experience the same self-doubt and loathing that comes from a belief in that heinous practice. I hated the words woman and women as a girl because I believed we weren't as valuable as men in the eyes of God. I actually felt sharp physical pain when I heard the words. Still catches me off guard from time to time. I will train my beautiful, smart, and capable daughters for partnership, not patriarchy. Thank you for showing me a picture of faithful unorthodoxy. I sent the book to a number of sort of scholars who are doing a lot of speaking and being listened to. I received back from Patrick Mason, I hope the book is changing minds and conversations across the church. Thanks for all you do. And from John Ogden, a number of things here. I certainly agree with you that the doctrine of eternal polygamy contains no truth, beauty, and goodness. I hope the church officially speaks out against it and DNC 132. My friend Fiona Gibbons sent me several lovely, encouraging things by phone and by email. This book needed to be written by you with your kindness and delicacy in all things sensitive and potentially explosive. May the Lord continue to bless you for your prescience and courage. Just a couple of weeks ago, I met Denver Snuffer. Do you know who he is? Some of you do. Some of you don't. Through a friend, it just happened to happen that we had lunch together, and I gave him a copy of the book, and he wrote back this glowing thing to me, part of which, I didn't write it down, but he was just thrilled with the book and said there were many places he felt like standing up and cheering. Oh, I met Lester Bush. You know who he is? He's the gentleman who back in 1972 wrote that foundational essay in Dialogue that, in a scholarly way, opened up the whole discussion about the efficacy of the policy on all those revelations, supposedly, about the black people not being able to hold the priesthood. So last September, I happened to meet him at the home of Greg Prince, and Lester said, "Hey," he said, "I chose the easy one. You chose the hard one." He said, "My subject had not been canonized." there's a number more. One from my old high school friend. "What a brave book you've written. Go, girl, go." Oh, well, and here's one that will make you giggle. From a dear friend of mine who totally loves the book. He said, "What? You sent copies to all the general authorities and to their wives? You're going to be the first person in Mormon history to be excommunicated for impudence." So, yes, to give a full history of the year since I was here, in September I did send a signed copy of this book to all 15 of the top general authorities. The package included a copy signed by name to each of their wives. Also, a copy of the church historian to the head of church PR, to Sherry Dew, and any other number, all of the top Relief Society women and young women's leaders and primary leaders. So I have not been hiding this book. I've been putting it all out there. And no, I haven't received back any notes from any of those people, nor did I expect to. But just to know that it is there in their offices somewhere is a very great pleasure to me. And it makes me happy that at least my part of this is done. And whatever any of them choose to do, it will be their own choice. But I have been blessed to do mine.
Would you share, there was a timing of Elder Holland giving a talk where he mentioned something that you mentioned in the book about female genital mutilation. So we don't know that there's a timing here, but it was...
Somebody sent me a note. Who was that? No, it wasn't just somebody. It was somebody who knew, somebody really very well informed, that in a talk that Elder Holland gave to a non-LDS group in England. But the person who said it to me quoted what he had said and said, "This is the first time in history that any LDS authority has used the word genital mutilation as one of the terrible things that's going on in the world.
And it was like within a month of him receiving the book.
Yeah, that's true. And there's no way to know, even if he had read the book or if that was imprinted in his mind. But I hope that a lot of the... I believe that many of the brethren at least scanned it. And I believe that many of them gave it to an assistant to say, read this whole thing and tell me what I should be... if I should read it or whatever. So there are all of these seeds that have been planted with them and with a lot of lesser authorities for which I am very grateful. And I think I will just conclude on another statement from somebody in my ward before I leave my ward, and I'm not going to quote anything from my bishop or my stake president, but I have received very encouraging, very appreciative comments from both of them. In fact, because it's a good thing maybe to give good examples, I will tell you that just before a couple of weeks before I knew the book was going to be ready to go out, I asked my bishop and my stake president for a meeting with each of them separately, because I wanted to tell them that the book was coming and what it was going to contain, what I intended to be doing. And the meetings went wonderfully well. The bishop and his wife came over to my home when we had a great meeting. I read some things, and they were very, very interested and excited to take the book home. And similarly with my bishop, after we had a very good conversation and I read a few passages and told him that I would be doing probably a lot of interviews and speaking. Anyway, this dear man, this young man, who you do not find a more devoted, helpful, good bishop, he said, Carolyn, may I give you a blessing? I said, of course. So he gave me just a very lovely blessing, giving me strength of body and mind and spirit for whatever was ahead of me, and that I would be able to find the words to use when I was in public. And so I am deeply appreciative of what I have received from the leadership in my ward and stake, and from the members in my ward and stake. Just last Saturday, we had our annual Pioneer Day celebration down at the park. And you know those Mormons and the food that they bring and the pork that they can pull and all of the... all of the good things and the fun and the watermelon eating contests and the this and the that. And it was just a glorious, happy time together. So I was sitting at the table and a young man in the ward came over, he and his wife have about three children. And I knew that they had never talked to them personally, but I sort of knew they had some significant questions of their own. Anyway, he sat down right in front of me, said, Carolyn, my wife finished your book, and then she took a trip, and I read the book while she was gone, and so I finished it. And I need to tell you, your book gave me a thought I have never, ever had in my life. He said, I have always thought, okay, I have two choices. I can stay in the church, I can leave the church, but now, thanks to you, I see if I choose, I can help the church. So that's my experience of this year. Thank you.
Isn't she awesome? I have long loved and admired Carolyn. She moved into my hometown when I was still living at home and had a mother who often read and recited her poetry to me. So she's really special to me. And as a fun little side note, my nephew happens to be her bishop. I have a little story to share with you about the title of the book is The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, Haunting the Hearts and Heaven of Mormon Women and Men. And my little story is a bit about the haunting part. To preface, my mother and father have had an absolutely beautiful marriage and relationship and friendship. As a child, I thought everyone's parents wanted to spend every possible minute together and go on sunset strolls through the neighborhood holding hands and wear matching clothes when they were out in public. I remember as a teenager my mother sharing with me about having had a dream, and in this dream she walked into the cellar of their home and saw a beautiful woman sitting on a stool with long dark hair shelling peas. My mother was startled to see her, didn't know who she was, and then in this dream my father walked into the room and introduced this woman to my mother as his new wife. This opened up for my mom and I the first of many conversations about polygamy. At this age for me, I was only aware that Brigham Young had practiced polygamy in Utah with the saints here. I didn't really know about Nauvoo polygamy then. But I was very uncomfortable with what I knew. My mom also shared with me that she did not understand polygamy, and that she and my father, after having had this dream, had discussed it at length and decided that no matter what, they would not be willing to practice it. It was only ever going to be the two of them and their beautiful love story. I remember feeling comforted at that thought, that my parents were not going to live this practice, no matter what. I had heard members of the church say that they thought it would be the higher law that we would all live someday. I have to tell you that polygamy is at the very foundation of what brought me to a place of questioning and learning new information and my changing faith and beliefs. I took it off the shelf about 7 years ago, where I had carefully placed it and labeled it with, "I don't understand this." I have spent years now reading and listening to podcasts and then reading and listening some more. And the more I learned, the messier it got. My father died very suddenly and unexpectedly 19 years ago, and my mother has now spent many years alone as a widow. For the past 3 to 4 years, she has been struggling with dementia and living in a memory care home. She lives in a very confused place in her mind, but has moments of clarity. You just never know what each day will bring, and I don't completely understand what goes on in the brain with dementia, but it seems to me that at least with my mom, sometimes bits and pieces of past memories and thoughts are floating around in her mind, and then they collide and they create a scenario that is not real. But in that moment, to her, it is very real and can often be emotional. Last September, shortly after I read Carolyn Pearson's book, The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, I went to visit my mom. It was a beautiful day outside, so I took her in her wheelchair outside of the building to go for a walk. And as soon as we were outside and alone, she very clearly said to me, "Your father is coming today with his girlfriend, and that they would be getting engaged soon." I was stunned to hear her say that. I completely was taken off guard. And even in her confused state, I thought, how could she be concerned about my father, who had been gone 19 years, taking on another wife? At first, I thought to myself, she is just confused in her mind. It's the dementia, right? Maybe, partly. My mind was racing, and I could not believe what I was hearing. I began to remind her of all the long talks she and I had had about how she and my father had agreed that they would never practice this or allow this into their marriage. She looked at me and quietly said, "Geralee, I don't think there is much I can do about it." My mind began to race with thoughts of all kinds of things. I thought of Emma Smith and the many women who have become the ghosts of our past messy history with polygamy. In my logical mind, I know she can say some crazy stuff, but this was not something she had just pulled out of thin air. Somewhere in her mind were bits and pieces, maybe even some fear about this principle, that she knew had been part of our early church history, and that we have heard that we may be asked to live this in the eternities. Those things may be still deeply seated in her mind. I already had all these thoughts about the pain of this practice and what it has caused for thousands of people, mostly women. And now my 88-year-old mother, in her very confused state of dementia, was being haunted by the idea that my father may be taking another wife. I thought to myself, why does my mother even have to have this crazy thought of polygamy haunting her in her old age? I know what the teaching is, that there are no marriages that take place in the spirit world. And I know that this was not a real thing. But it certainly effectively set off all kinds of emotions in me that day. My poor, confused mother. And for her, it is not even a reality. But then there are all the women for whom it is a reality. Those in our past history and those who today are still living with the difficulty and pain of these ceilings as we practice them currently. I am so very grateful in this moment for Carolyn Pearson's work on this topic, that we are getting the information out there and that we are talking about it. We need to talk about this. And hopefully someday we can eventually get this straightened out. When Carolyn Pearson says haunting the hearts, she is right. It is doing just that for some. And I experienced a little bit of that with my mother on that beautiful fall day. Thank you.
Well, Carolyn, your book has affected me. I'm here. You put my story and Jane's story in your book, so it's obviously affected me a lot. I like to see both sides of things, so I tried to think what could be some positive things that polygamy has contributed. Polygamy helped me place me where I'm most comfortable being as an outlier. I'm unsealed to my spouse and children, and I yet still believe in God, Joseph's prophetic calling, and the efficacy of temple ritual. It caused me at a young age to walk more by faith, recognize that we need to look at the intent of teachings and policy rather than just their outward appearance, and live more simply and in the present. Having to confront a policy and doctrine that on the face of it hindered my marriage and mortality and my status in the eternities has been revealing. It revealed to me that we worry too much about trying to be certain about what's going to happen in the next life. By my second date with Jane, I discovered that she had been sealed to her deceased husband, and that fact had caused some of her prior serious suitors to abandon her. She had already suffered watching the man she loved go through cancer treatments and die in their brief 10 months of marriage. And then she was left with the burden of paying for the funeral and settling debts in her and his affairs, and then the grieving and trying to rebuild her life. Despite my youth and immaturity of age 21, there was no way that this woman, who had finally said yes to my multiple requests to take her out, there was no way I wanted to add to her past suffering. So I decided before we dated anymore that I needed to investigate and make sure I could be comfortable with not being sealed. I think the fact that we have been married 35 years, come the day of the great solar eclipse on August 21, speaks to what my study, prayer, and fasting revealed to me. I was fortunate within the first month of my mission to experience a profound faith crisis. It caused me to seriously consider if there was a God and his or her character. Suddenly something that Joseph referred to as utmost importance, the character of God. It has become my touchstone for all seemingly unanswerable questions, and it served me well in deciding to marry Jane. If I chose to believe in God, he or she must be just, merciful, and have the welfare and progression of their children as their primary concern. If policies, doctrines, and such don't align with that, then we are worshiping a God in man's image rather than being a greater than ourselves. Carolyn's book has helped me realize that my not being able to be sealed to Jane or my children is associated with the doctrine of polygamy. I just simply thought of it as the policy of not allowing a woman to be sealed to more than one man while both men are alive, while a man can be sealed to more than one woman while he is alive. This seemed patently unfair, but I didn't think about how obviously rooted in polygamy it was. You know, I'd read Emma, Mormon Enigma, years ago when it came out, and The Mormon Experience by Leonard Arrington, and Rough Stone Rolling when it was published. I knew that Joseph revealed polygamy for as long as I can remember. But I didn't realize until 4 or so years ago that it was so very messy. I had no idea the trouble it was still causing people, especially women, until Carolyn's book and Lindsay Hansen's Park Year of Polygamy podcast. All this left me with feeling that polygamy was a doctrine that has borne more bitter fruit than sweet. And I believe at the end of the day, that is the most important yardstick. I'm grateful to Carolyn for doing such a wise and brave thing, and I found her book a masterful piece of poetry, history, research, and a powerful call to action. I hope we as individuals and as a church become the change we want to see. But for the church to recant what has been so directly taught as revelation, found in our standard works, as an identity that we were almost exterminated by, driven to the West by, and nearly shut down by, such a task. And what would such revoking or repenting reveal? It would reveal that prophets and our people can get revelation very wrong, which makes all revelation suspect, which means each member needs to be responsible and not depend on prophets as if they were some autopilot taking them to heaven. This is good and healthy for us because we are at a pivotal time in the church where we need to review all our revelations and policies and see what's working and what isn't. This is not unusual. It has happened throughout Scripture and continues to this day. We should always be asking ourselves, does this idea, policy, doctrine, or procedure measure up to a loving, equitable God? Just last Saturday, I was walking back from helping with the children's Days of 47 parade, and I wandered into Gilgal Gardens. Hadn't intended to. Ended up talking for about 20 minutes to a 20-something who had just resigned from the church 6 days earlier. He strongly intimated that his leaving had to do with polygamy. He was very mysterious about it. He wouldn't tell me the details. As much as he was trying to be self-aware and compassionate, it was hard for him not to express a deep resentment for the church, and especially its leaders. Evil is a word he used a lot. He was hoping to convert me away from the church. We need to change how we teach. We say we want people to come to the truth on their own terms, but testify there was only one option, ours. So if someone doesn't arrive at our conclusion, something is wrong with them. That seems manipulative, which is a word that this gentleman used a lot. We need to pay better attention to DNC 121. We as a people have and continue to manipulate and control in overt and subtle ways. I kind of know this because as a father I did this. We justify the means because of the end. At times we use deception. It's our history of polygamy, I've come to think, that the deception used in its inception, as well as after the manifesto, laid the groundwork for these dangerous and unhealthy behaviors, as did claimed revelations to individuals with God threatening physical destruction of those who defied the commandment of polygamy. This flies in the face of DNC 121. There's other people that I've come across this last year. Lance Allred spoke at TEDx last year at Salt Lake City, coming from, you know, a Mormonist fundamentalist. And he tied in his experience into polygamy and the LGBT rights, which I thought was interesting. Tom Bennett, who's here today, we gave Tom a ride from Ogden a few years ago, and we heard his story of being a missionary here in Salt Lake City and having the fundamentalists come after him, try to convert him and have him speak for them. It kind of messed up his faith in the church. Just yesterday, I spoke to a friend who called me from Washington who has left our church and joined another Christian church. And he expressed his mother, who passed away last year, lived in fear that her husband, who had passed away some 20 years prior to her, would like his first wife better. He was sealed to both wives, and this troubled her greatly until the day she died. Our own son, Ben. When I mentioned this last Sunday that Jane and I were going to be on this panel, he, as a returned missionary, and who is an evangelical atheist, with great passion asked how we could dislike Trump so much when Joseph was such a worse human who has harmed so many more people. While I don't agree with his character comparison, had Joseph Smith not veered into polygamy, his and the church's credibility would be vastly better, I think. One has to wonder what things would look like if polygamy had not existed. So why can we not see mortals, prophets as mere mortals? Sorry. What is wrong with that? Are we troubled that God lets even his chosen servants do really stupid things? How can he not and still respect our agency? Are we not willing to allow our heroes their flaws and personal deceptions as we do ourselves and learn from their mistakes as well as their successes? Karen's invaluable book tills the ground for restoring Joseph Smith to a more fully formed and valuable leader, an inspired, beautiful prophet who got some things really, really wrong. We can learn from such a life, and as we are not to judge, especially with this errant information as history often provides, and set in a different culture and norm than ours, we do not need nor do we have the wisdom to denigrate those who perceive from hindsight that we perceive from hindsight to have erred. The golden rule applies to how we treat those who have passed on as well as to those who live among us. We are taught that we can rightly discern through the light of Christ ideas and actions that are good and evil. I'm hopeful that Carolyn's heroic efforts at ghost busting will eventually bear fruit. I think we should do t-shirts, ghost busting t-shirts. But it will depend most of all on members having the maturity to be responsible for living the first two commandments. This is a God of equitable love, and we can't love him without equitably loving one another and thoughtfully measuring the fruits of our beliefs. Thank you.
Good afternoon. First, I want to thank Carolyn for giving voice not only to our story, but to countless stories of both women and men. Carolyn, I do consider you one of the wise women elders of our church. Yeah. Thank you for agreeing with that. I'd actually like to begin my remarks and also end in Carolyn's words, because she says it much more beautifully than I can. On page 2 of the book, she says, "Telling these stories will require time and care, but in a way it will be as easy as letting birds out of a cage. Thoughts are things and words have wings. These stories have long been consigned to small spaces, cramped and whispering places, and I smile as I free them. They will unfurl their wings and fly and alight where they will be noticed, homing pigeons that have never had a home, carrying scrawled messages on notes that say, 'Please help.'" I don't know if Lindsay Hanson Park is in the audience, but I'd also like to thank her for her bravery in delving so deeply into her Year of Polygamy podcasts. It's one of the most, I don't know, frightful and painful yet informative things that I've ever listened to. There's so many facets to this issue, and Jay's and my story is just one angle. And yes, we are on page 100. And even though our story only takes up about 2 pages, I honestly could not get through it in one sitting. That's how painful it is for me. And to see it in print was something completely different for me. So Jay's told you a little bit about our story, and I just have a very few and brief thoughts about how this has affected my life, and it's completely from my own perspective. The first thought being that it's clear that this not only brings grief to women, but in our case, also to my good husband, Jay. If you believe the doctrine of the LDS Church, one has to be sealed in order to reach the highest glory of the celestial kingdom. Either that or, I guess, donate to Sunstone, I learned today. So, but I have always looked at that teaching as spiritually abusive. It's terrible to tell someone that. I was a young widow at age 23, and I wanted a family and to be married. This is what I didn't want to do. But the way I saw it, I had two options, and that was to either find a widower who had been already sealed to a woman and didn't care about being sealed to anyone else. Seems like a strange criteria. Or I would have to marry outside the church, and neither one of those at the time seemed like viable options. And I have since known several young women placed in this very same terrible predicament and watched their pain. It's easy for people to say, trust Heavenly Father because it will all work out. But it's one thing to say that, and it's another thing to live it every day. Jay and I have three children, two biological sons and one adopted daughter. We adopted her at age three, and we were faced with the predicament of taking her to the temple and having Jay stand in proxy for my first husband. We couldn't reconcile that. And so we have two sons who are evidently sealed to a man they've never met, and our daughter who's not sealed to anyone. For me, the only sealing power I need is love. My pain over this issue has affected my temple worship to the point that I have finally relinquished my temple recommend, and I have been able to release the guilt. The issue has also ultimately, among other issues, affected my activity and my engagement in the church. Some may call that weakness, but after 40 years, it's just gotten too difficult for me to swallow. I'll end with Carolyn's words again. And if I understand correctly, these words were spoken in the same room that Joseph Smith translated section 132. Dear God, our mother and father, excuse me, she does say, Dear God, our father and mother, who art in heaven and in our hearts and in this room, I am so grateful to be standing here. I am grateful for the beautiful and important things that happened in this city and in this building. And now, as a member of the church that Joseph founded, as a Mormon woman who has been blessed by many things that happened here, but has been deeply wounded in consequence of something that transpired in this room, I take it upon myself to pronounce a healing blessing. I bless the hurt that has developed from some of the words that were written in this room. Words in what is known as Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Words that through many generations have harmed the hearts and lives of countless Mormon women and men, that this hurt will have an end, that the damage done by the concept of eternal polygamy will cease, that the wrong will be righted, and that soon there will be a time of new light, of healing, and of peace. Through the power of my love and my faith, I pronounce that this blessing will be fulfilled, and I, Carolyn Pearson, do it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
We have exactly 30 minutes. Please come up to this microphone here on this front table and continue the sharing.
Sharing a story and a question, if that's allowed. My great-grandfather had four wives in the American Fork area. My grandfather was one of the children of one of the wives. He was not a happy man. My father, his son, was not a happy man. I bear the scars of that unhappiness. My daughter bears the scars. My grandchildren bear the scars. I cannot point to the polygamy, but I strongly suspect that the genesis of that pain began with the construction of that polygamous family. So that's my story. My question is, last night I came to the newbie dinner, sat by a man, intelligent, kind, sincere, who's presenting at this conference, and he is a polygamist. He was quick to assure me, not FLDS, they're abusive, but we're the good polygamists. My question to the panel, is there such a thing as good polygamy?
Of course there is such a thing as good polygamists. Whether there is a thing as good polygamy, I have a personal doubt that I just do not believe in my heart that polygamy adds goodness and value and love to this world. I know that there would be people who would disagree, very good-hearted people. And so those people themselves certainly are good. But I'm so interested in the first part of your comment there. And I sort of resonate with it in my own particular kind of way. I do believe that, you know, we talk about the sins of the fathers resonating down. I'm interested in the idea of the pains of our fathers and our mothers resonating down. And even I think some smart people, way smarter than I, maybe even the particle physicists are determining that our cells might carry memory. So how to exorcise the ghost of polygamy, if indeed that is a primary thing that is influencing what you spoke of? I think the absolute best way to do that, and you could possibly find some skilled therapists, psychotherapists, who work in the field of how to make changes in the brain's way of remembering and way of processing things. But even just on your own, and I'm committed to doing this for my own self, of living a personal life that is free of the pain, the confusion, the guilt, whatever it is that you feel you may have inherited. Because I really believe that as we ourselves manage to create lives that are full and healthy and clear and clean and open to only good things and rejecting of things that hurt and doing our best to do that for everybody around us, that as we and our daughters and sons can create lives that resonate to the best possibility only the goodness and the brightness and the light and the love and the joy, insofar as it's humanly possible for us to do that, then I believe that resonates not only down to future generations, but up to the generations before. And that those generations above us who were the initial participants in the pain and the grief and the confusion that came from polygamy, that our being free from that burden can help them to be released from that burden as well. And that, I think, is work for the dead that I can really get behind.
John was next. Then Glenn. Glenn, you can be after John. Okay.
Well, I'll share a quick story and ask a question, too. I know some horror stories of polygamy from my own family, and one of them ended with my great-grandmother, Charlotte, taking a baseball bat to my great-grandfather's Model T and then leaving him and traveling first to Salt Lake and making a life on her own and then eventually moving out east. So I'm familiar firsthand with some of the pain created by that, by polygamy. My question is, you know, I hear so many stories of LGBT Mormon youth who talk about their dream of taking their same-sex loved one to the temple and being sealed. And when I think about my relationship with my husband, whom I love dearly, for me, heaven is not heaven without being connected to him eternally. And, you know, there's a power in that idea of sealing power. And so I guess my question is, can we jettison Section 132 and salvage that the idea of sealing power and eternal family?
I'll be glad to let somebody else also address that. But actually, in my book, I did not say jettison. I suggested that they receive an inspired revision. And what do I know? I know, John, I know so little about any of this stuff. But I just have a firm belief that somehow or other, the only glue that holds people together here and in eternity is the glue that we call love. And I believe that our father / mother in heaven, or mother and father in heaven, however that actually works, has a paradigm in store for us that is so much larger than how we can place it on our charts just now. And as I wrote in this book, I really think that somehow there will be an opportunity for all of us to relate in whatever loving fashion is appropriate with every human being that we have ever known and loved in this world. So I hope that you and your dear one will not spend any time really worrying about that. God is so much larger than our words about him, her. Oh, and I had one more thought for the first lady that spoke. Wait, where did it go? Oh, it was a good thought. It'll come back to me.
Thanks, Glenn. Come on up.
One thing, and I love the book, but I think a bit controversially, one of the questions I left with, a lot of people seem to relate to the concept of ceiling. And I was left with, I remember thinking, what the hell does ceiling mean? Because it comes across as almost ownership to me. And I can understand being committed or having a relationship of love by choice. But the idea of ceiling, especially after reading this book, and, you know, I just heard John say he wants to be sealed, I've lost a sense of what that's supposed to mean, because ownership doesn't appeal to me. And as a therapist, I've heard a lot of women say, I can't bear the thought if my children aren't righteous enough to be sealed to me. And I think, what does that mean? Is there this irrevocable sense of guilt? And then I also think, according to church doctrine, they're not sealed to you anyway. They seal to the paternal line, since it's patriarchal. So I raise the question of the panel, of you, what does sealing mean to you? Because I left very troubled with the concept, which is comforting to a lot of people, that they're sealed. It seems like also to me, sometimes it seems infantilized. That I hear a lot of parents say, I just love my little children and I want them to be sealed. But we grow up and we're adults, and I see love as a choice between people rather than this obligation of patriarchy. So, and I don't try to say this with any disrespect, because I know that's a huge tenet and a great comfort to many people. But particularly after reading the book, I came up with the question, what does sealing mean? It did not seem comforting to me. It seemed more like a patriarchal ownership sort of thing. So I just raise that, and I don't know if anybody else feels or asks those questions.
Well, I think we'd all be happy to just let Carolyn Pearson answer all of these, because she's so amazing. But I, as the parent of four adult children, two of whom are no longer members of the church, I understand the fear that you're talking about, that parents speak to, about I can't even imagine that my children wouldn't be sealed, because I felt that. But I've been on a journey of my own where I now no longer fear that. And with my children that are out of the church, I completely honor their choices. And I don't secretly hope that they will come back, because I think they're fine. And I believe that in our family, we are bonds of love, as Carolyn has so, you know, brilliantly stated, are the things that seal us together. But how I tell somebody that, who's in the pain of a child, an adult child, who's making choices that they don't agree with. You know, we talk a lot in the church about agency. I heard about it all growing up in the church, right? Been a member my whole life. We don't talk about how to deal with it with your kids when they make choices that you don't really want them to make, you know? And how do you honor that? And I learned this from my friend Dan. So about 7 years ago, my oldest son came to us in what I would call a complete faith deconstruction, or near complete. He was in a PhD program. And I was in a world of hurt. I did not know how to handle this. And I reached out to Dan because I had heard him interviewed by John DeLynn in a podcast where he spoke about his own experience in a PhD program, and it mirrored what my son had experienced. And so I reached out to him, and one of the most profound things he said to me was that I needed to learn to honor his journey. And that was a painful process. It wasn't easy, but I think I get it now. And so I really see both sides of this. I totally understand that parent who can't imagine that maybe their son wouldn't go on a mission or wouldn't get married in the temple and wouldn't be sealed for eternally. I get that feeling. I've been there. But I also now feel completely peaceful about the fact that there's more than one path, I think, that gets us there. So that would be my response.
I've got something before. This is back to the editing process with Carolyn, and you know, of course, I'm just sitting there reading these magnificent words. So imagine I didn't really shape any words. I did a lot of, but we had many good conversations, you know. And it was the personal voices sections that, to me, I kept wanting to do the man thing. It's like, well, here's the explanation that would take away your pain. And one of those was related to what you're talking about, Glenn, you know, because I sense that within our church we have a sense. And like, I remember when my wife and I were getting, you know, ready to be sealed and all that stuff, our stake president goes, well, you know that the sealing is just a promise that if you, you know, live faithfully and if you continue to choose each other and all those different things, then at some point this Holy Spirit of promise sort of actually does the sealing, the welding. And I was reading these stories of so many people that were feeling trapped by something that they, you know, did when they were young. Or, you know, they were sort of felt like there was this binding in heaven that was unbreakable. And I kept wanting to, like, insert this theology, you know, into their lives. But, again, this was to free stories like birds, you know, that had been caged up. And so we didn't go there, as I recall. We didn't do much there at all. I don't know that I influenced anything in that area, but I just wanted you to know I had that same experience with you, Glenn. It's just like, what does it mean? And it doesn't feel like it's a done deal when, you know, the ritual happens. And I think that's good Mormon theology that it wouldn't be, but yet I know that lots of people haven't, you know, that, like, minimizes their pain. And so I was glad we didn't go hard in the book. Is that okay to say?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. Please come up here, and there's just about 14 minutes left. So,
Oh, Jay, I had something too.
Just real quick one.
So let's see. So you first, you, then you. Okay, that'll be probably all the three. Maybe you. Okay, we hope to get to this. We're looking for four within 15 minutes.
So I had to kind of process this knowing that I wouldn't be sealed to anybody besides my parents. You know, and this is where I, when I was speaking earlier, where we need to look beyond the surface of doctrine and try to understand maybe the intent. I think the intent, I mean, if you theoretically took Adam and Eve, assuming they're real characters, and all their children from then on lived all the commandments perfectly, again, in our perfect world theology of Mormonism, I mean, everybody would be sealed to everybody from Adam on Eve to everybody in this room, right? I mean, it would be one giant, sealed, happy family. I think the impulse of the idea is that we are one family, not often happy, all of us together, but that would be the hope and the ideal, that this concrete ordinance, this sealing, might have the impetus to push us towards being connected and committed to loving one another. So that's how I've resolved the sealing thing.
Please.
Okay, I'm feeling like I'm in testimony meeting. My heart is just beating, and I'm up here in front of these people, and I don't want to be, but I have to get up here because I can't sit. But the reason that I wanted to talk, and it kind of takes us maybe off on another tangent, but I have always been bothered by this polygamy issue, as we're talking about today, and I appreciate Carolyn and her insight into it, and all her book has done for me. And my husband finally read it and said, I get it now, okay, I'm not going to take in another wife, so thank you, thank you, thank you. But I think as a Mormon woman with this issue, I've kind of taken a repentance process, and I thought there are tens of thousands of people in our valley still enmeshed in polygamy, and having such difficulty as they choose to leave. And so my way of saying, hey, we started this, so what can I do to help and assist those that are still involved? And the damage that is done to them and their lives. So I have become involved in organizations like Kristen Decker's and jumped in and helped and assisted some of the young people that leave and provided a safety net for them and opened our house to them. So we've had the fortunate experience of having a young man from FLDS and a young man from the Kingston group kind of join our family and become part of us and help them get through that difficult transition as they leave, which has been amazing. And I suggest that all of you look into that and consider that. But one of the most amazing things is we've gathered around our table, our kitchen table. We've had a young woman from FLDS, a young man from FLDS, a young man from the AUB group, a woman from the AUB group, and also just all the groups, and a Mormon woman gathering around the table trying to solve the problems that have been created by this. And we've become best of friends, and it's just a beautiful thing, and it's been one of the greatest experiences of my life to participate in that. And it's also helped the guilt that I feel as a result of this policy that was started by my ancestors. And so I wanted to thank Carolyn, and also as a result of having one of these young men in our house, it's taken 4 years for him to finally come to the grips with the fact that he's also gay. And so in dealing with that, your books have become my Bible. And they've been ever so helpful, and I just want to thank you for all you've done to assist me through this. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, years ago, 20 or more, I got very involved in genealogy, and I came across a letter was an official letter from the First Presidency that stated if a woman had passed away and she'd been married more than one time and hadn't been sealed to both husbands, that she could be sealed to both of them. And that's been years ago. I think I could dig that letter out in my files from somewhere, and I just don't want to know if that's
sure,
still
that's,
the policy.
That's true. That happened a long time ago, but only if she and all of the possible husbands are dead.
Right.
Yeah.
So well, I think most people are unaware of that, and I haven't heard anybody even talk about it.
I don't know that it's been major broadcast, but I don't consider it top headline news.
No.
I mean, really.
Okay.
So, did you want?
Oh, I don't. Anyway, no. Thank you, though. But there's lots of messy, interesting things.
I did remember that one thought that I had. Where's the lady who was speaking first? There. Okay. I'm really thinking about your circumstance there, and especially, you know, with you, and it was a daughter that you spoke of, right, that may have inherited some sadness. I would recommend that you really jump in and not avoid the thing. Jump in and study polygamy. If you think that's what is something that's holding you back, read this book together, perhaps, The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy. Maybe do research on your own. But the thought that occurred, when we really face something, is easier to get rid of it. If you face a ghost, it can dissolve. If you let it just be in your house and keep looking away, then it can really trouble you. So I say jump in and study polygamy for all you've got if you think that's something that's harmful. But here's the thought that it came to me. And it's a quote that I found, I don't know, some Eastern guru, I forgot who it was. But at the time that I read it, I thought, ooh, there's something that I like here. And it's just a statement that says that it's helpful often to look at the past as fate and the future as pure opportunity. So whatever happened in our past, in any of our families, let's just say it happened. Maybe it had to happen. We don't know. It's not our business, but it happened. That, for us, can be fate. But right now, for you and me and your daughter and all of us moving forward, it is only pure opportunity.
Sir, you're next. And then hopefully that final person, so we'll see.
Hi, Carolyn. So I read this book about a year ago. Carolyn and I, and I'm Josh Weed. We've never met in person, so she might not recognize me, but we had spoken, and I read the book about a year ago, no, over a year ago, and I did not understand the relevance that it would soon have for me. I read it, and I was very deeply moved by the stories in it, and then... my mom passed away in May of last year, and my dad, who had always said that he would not remarry, and that if he did remarry, he would not be sealed in the temple, decided to get sealed to another woman. So my mom had been buried 3 months, and my dad literally came to my home, and in that visit had said, of course I would not need to be sealed to another woman. I can populate, you know, according to the LDS doctrine, I can populate worlds with your mom, and we have eternity. That's plenty of time. We don't need other people to join us for that endeavor. And 5 days after saying that, he texted me saying that he was engaged to be married and to be sealed to another woman. That was very painful. And the stories from the book came flooding back to me with profound resonance, and the pain was immense. It and compounded the grief of simply losing my mom. But then I just wanted to share, I did have an alleviation of that pain a little bit that happened in a really random way. I started researching polygamy even more, so I started listening to Lindsay Hanson Park's famous podcast series. And my wife Lolly and I were listening to it in the car. Our kids were allegedly sleeping, but my oldest daughter was awake and was like, "Daddy," and what? Oh no! Like, what have I just exposed you to at the age of 10? This is heady stuff. And she had heard kind of the initial podcast about Joseph Smith and about his introduction of polygamy. And she was like, "Did Joseph Smith do that? Did he have a polygamist? Did he cheat on his wife?" was the question she asked. And, you know, is this real? And I started kind of going into this very kind of egalitarian, like, some people believe that one way, other people believe another way. And she just interrupted me, and I wrote down what she said because it touched me so much. She just very simply was like, I don't think a prophet should have 30 wives, and I don't think Heavenly Father would tell him to cheat on his wife. I feel like Heavenly Father is giving me an answer about this right now. I think it was a mistake. It is plainly written all over that that was the wrong thing. He even said so himself. And suddenly I was like, I don't need to be like some egalitarian, like, maybe this is something I believe, you know, like... I was able to just let that go, that I could join her in that simple faith and that simple kind of internal assurance. Anyway, so that was very moving and helpful for me at that point.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for your book.
Last person who wanted to get in, let's have you come up real fast. Thanks.
I just wanted to address the sealing thing, especially to this gentleman here. When I left the Mormon Church, which hasn't been all of that long, possibly the most difficult thing that I dealt with was the sealing power. It was really, really difficult for me. I still have a lot of siblings that are very active. My whole I come from a very Mormon family. This was very, very difficult. I'm going to be cut off from my family that I came from. My husband and I are not going to go into eternity together. And by the way, because of this polygamy thing, and because those of you who have been to the temple and have listened to the words, when a man and woman are sealed, no, they are not good words. And I reject them. Anyway, that was very difficult for me, and I had images of Donald Trump's wall, and I said, my God does not build walls. I reject that God builds walls between people who love each other. That is inconceivable to me, and I reject that notion. And as has been said here by other individuals, it's love. I mean, what we always say, God is love, God is love, God is love. I've been taught that from the time I was a young child. If God is love, is he going to separate people out of vengeance? because they love each other. Anyway, that is where I come from. Also, I'm just going to throw out, in a couple of years, my husband and I will have been married 50 years, and I love this man. We will go into the eternities as equals. And anyway, on our 50th anniversary, we're going to be redoing our vows and as equal partners. We will be partners, or I'm not going there.
Yeah, wonderful.
Okay, that's all I've got to say.
Thank you, everyone, for this rich 90 minutes that we've had together. I do want to quickly say something that Benchmark Books has the book. Many, many copies. They ran out last year. Carolyn sort of saved us from a private stash, so there would be an even... Okay, so you'll be able to find her. She's also speaking, I believe, on Saturday about moving from patriarchy to partnership, which some of you will recognize that. She and Julie Diaz of Idaho Hanks, so there'll be more chances to interact with her. But I hope you'll go visit Benchmark Books. Anything you buy down there does also help Sunstone. Maybe that's the thing to get into that celestial kingdom. But anyway, thank you, and thank you, Carolyn. We honor you. We love this work, and you are so powerful.